I first started correction, the mindset was, okay, they did the crime, now let's make them do the time. You know, you couldn't go tell a detainee good morning. You couldn't tell him good night. You couldn't shake his hand. Because if anybody saw that, then, you were fired on the spot. It was against policy. You know, and I think all that has changed now. I think now we want to establish that relationship with the detainee. You know, you want to go in there. You want to make your rounds. You basically want to pick his brain. Hey, how are you doing today? Good morning. Good afternoon. How are you doing today? You know, have you talked to your kids? You know, just establishing that relationship and knowing your population.
Welcome to the Reimagining Prison Podcast. Today, our guest is Alex Sanchez. Alex is the warden at the IAH Secure Adult Detention Facility in Texas. Alex has been in corrections nearly 20 years, starting as a CO. And we met through the Warden Exchange, and I really wanted to invite Alex to be a guest on the podcast for two reasons. Number one, we've interviewed a lot of correctional professionals in the last 3 years, but we've never had someone who was a warden at a detention center. So I thought that would be an interesting topic, and certainly I have questions about that. And secondly, he's an employee of MTC, Management and Training Corporation, which most of you know is a private prison entity, and they have a very unique philosophy centered around an acrostic, which is, as it's spelled, bionic, and we'll be talking about that as well. So Alex, welcome to the Reimagining Prison Podcast.
How you doing? Glad to be on here.
Good to have you. Why don't we start out by, why don't you tell us a little bit about your career history? And the reason I ask is, I have found most people in corrections never had corrections as their ideal job or career goal when they're younger in high school. And people come by a variety of avenues, number one, to work in corrections, and then secondly, those who choose to make it their career. So how did that happen for you? How did you get your start in corrections?
Okay, well, I'll begin by starting, to begin with, my family were migrants. So we basically migrated throughout the United States just looking for seasonal work. The day that I turned 18 and graduated from high school, originally, at least what my plans were to become a state trooper. Mm-hmm. To be a state trooper, you either had to have education or you had to have the experience, which at the time when I graduated, I had neither of. So I decided to use corrections as a stepping stone. You know, I figured I would do for 4 years and then I would apply speak to a recruiter and about recruiting me to be a state trooper, DPS for Texas. Mm-hmm. So 4 years into my career in corrections, which all my 20 years have always been with the privates. So mm-hmm. So my first 4 years was split in two, with Wackenhut and TCA. But after those 4 years is when I spoke to a recruiter for the state troopers. And basically what they told me that since it was with the privates and not a state facility, a certified state facility, those 4 years didn't count. So at that point in time is when I finally made my decision that I was going to stick it out with corrections and make it a career.
Okay. You say your family were migrant workers, seasonal workers around the country. I think, you know, sometimes the media gives us the idea, I certainly have, that people who do seasonal work mostly are people who come across the border to do seasonal work. But you're saying there's lots of people who are U.S. citizens who do that type of work. How does that work? I mean, what kind of states do you go to, and how do you get work like that?
Well, basically, I started working from at an early age to where the minute that you could hold a shovel or a hoe, you'd basically, you know, my family. My grandparents, or at least were raised in, had a home to them was in Ringville, Texas. So mm-hmm. Seasonal work pretty much is always up north, Ohio, Michigan, or even California, Florida. I mean, it just depends what season's in, which season it is, and which crop is in the season. And that's basically we would follow work. But a lot of people from at the time from inside the United States citizens were actually the ones that did it. People from lower South Texas, which is Brownsville, McAllen, Weslaco, Cherryland, Los Fresnos, all that area, a lot of the families would migrate up north to go do that seasonal work for farmers.
And I'm assuming that seasonal work mostly is physical labor, which would be very, very hard work.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I think that's one of the hardest jobs I've ever done, to be specific, picking cucumbers.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Wow. So you began your corrections career at 18. Where did you first work and how did you get that job?
Well, in Raymondville, Texas, even now currently, there's three private prisons that are operated there inside Raymondville, Texas. Two of which right now are operated by MTC, Management and Training Corporation, which is the company that I work for. And you have I don't exactly remember what that third prison is, but the third one is a state facility, which is where I originally started. Started as an officer there and stayed there for 4 years, even though they changed the different operators. But it's always the same customer. And then finally in 2006 is when MTC opened up there as well in Raymondville.
So you became an officer right out of high school. Looking back 20 years, I imagine there would be specific challenges to someone who's that young going to work in a correctional facility, particularly in the security side. For you looking back 20 years, what do you think the unique challenges were of someone at your age, and what advice would you have for someone entering corrections right out of high school?
You know, the challenges that I had was, one, I'm not the biggest individual. I'm 5'4". At the time, I was probably 175 pounds. that when you go across the United States, that's not the biggest individual. So sure. Going into that first job, the convicts at the time were offenders would, they test you. It was a state facility. And every time you went in there, I'll give you an example. When my original class started, we went through pre-service. I was the smallest guy. So yeah, we had a survey and I was predicted to be the first guy to either quit or get fired. But I just stayed with it. Went from there.
So when you enter corrections at 18, I'm curious to know, we talk a lot in the warning exchange about your philosophy of corrections, your why. And a lot of that would be pretty unformed right out of high school, maybe formed by media or film or TV or whatever. What did you think you were getting into? What was your idea of what corrections was about at the time? Did you think about things like that? Or
no, I did. Going into corrections, social media wasn't as big back in 2002. I think it was really getting a kickstart on. But, I had based off of movies, I had my own perception of what exactly corrections was. And, some of the movies that I saw, I don't think were to the level to where I started corrections. But yeah, you did see your fights. I mean, on a daily, you'd have your fights, your one-on-ones, your assaults, or even riots. I've been through riots. And, that pretty much was what I was expecting when going into working into a correctional setting.
What was your family's perception, and what did they think of you entering corrections as a job just out of high school? Any concerns from them, or what was their thoughts?
At first, no, they had no concerns. My dad understood. Like I mentioned, when I turned 18, I told him, look, just farm labor wasn't for me anymore, and I just wanted to do something better, something that didn't involve the sun.
You bet.
So they were happy that I got a job, and when I got into corrections, I think that's when it hit them, is because right straight into my career, I fell in love with the SORT, the Special Operations Response Team. So I think that's when it hit them, when I showed up at home with a duffel bag full of riot gear. So that's when they're like, okay, what exactly are you getting into? But they had their concerns, but I explained to them, look, there's policy, there's procedures, there's safeguards for what I do. And you know what, if I'm looking into being a state trooper, I think this would be a great stepping stone for me. So no, they supported me, but yeah, they had their worries.
Mm-hmm. So you're the warden at the secure adult detention facility in Texas. Who gets housed at a detention facility?
So yes, sir. I work at IEH Detention Center, which is located here in Livingston, Texas. And we have a contract with the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, referred to as ICE. Mm-hmm. And we housed here civil detainees who are either fighting their case or are pending their cases with immigration. So I housed, don't quote me, there's more, but I'll name a couple of the nationalities that we housed here.
Sure.
Brazil, China, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, India, Mexico, Nicaragua, Romania, Sri Lanka.
Wow.
Just to name a few.
That's quite a list of countries around the world. So basically, these are people who have either crossed the border illegally and are found living here illegally. And basically, who are the people that would bring them to you, so to speak?
It would be immigration. Again, we're contracted through immigration, but they and on our contract, we do have a transport team. But a majority of the time, ICE has their own contractors that they transport the detainees through to get them here to our facility.
And because you deal with so many different nationalities, and I assume then many different languages, how does staff communicate with so many different people from around the world?
Yes, sir. So right off the bat, the way that that we manage that challenge is we have a certified language translation service. So for example, if I had a China that would come in through my receiving and discharge, my staff would immediately call that number so we could explain, you know, the procedures, the policies, and the rules that for the facility that they're coming into, and to include any other questions that we have to ask them.
So how many people there at the detention center can you house?
I could house up to 1,052, sir.
Wow.
All male adults.
And then I suppose that then when the immigration people bring them to you, whether they have children or spouses or anything like that, you wouldn't necessarily be aware of that unless they told you. And if they would, they would go somewhere else.
That is correct, sir.
And how many staff do you have at your facility?
At my facility right now, currently, we have a total of 151 employees that are dedicated to preparing residents for reentry.
So this might be a weird question, but so if detainees who come to your facility because they're in the country illegally and ICE are the ones that picks them up, they're not necessarily in your facility because other than the being here illegally, they're not there for necessarily any other crime like most state correctional facilities. Would I understand that correctly?
That is correct, sir. We house them here according to what the charges that ICE has them for.
And then I believe they have to go before someone for the case to be heard. How does that work? Someone hears their side of the story, so to speak, and then they render a decision. What happens to them next?
Yes, sir. So they'll have that opportunity all in coordination with immigration, with ICE. So if they do want to fight their case, that's who they'll be speaking with. If they got somebody to represent them, then that's who they'll communicate with through the ICE office. And then that decision is made by either a federal judge or in coordination with ICE.
And then let's say, for example, a detainee loses the case and they're deported. Who actually does the deporting? You guys are housing them. Is there someone else that comes in and handles all that type of activity?
Typically, it's the same agency that drops them off in coordination with ICE. ICE coordinates all those.
Do you get any sense in talking to these men what their, I'm not sure if expectation is the correct word, but their response to the staff and how they're treated or the process they go through? Are they expecting something terrible when they wind up in a detention facility? Are they pleasantly surprised at the conditions that you provide? Do you have any sense of their expectations and their reactions to the reality of that?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with myself, to include the administration, and then on how we treat the detainees, to include because my employees, for example, they're gonna feed off how the administration acts. So when I go out there and I make rounds with the detainees, we explain to them about the bionic philosophy. I know you mentioned it earlier, which is believe it or not, I care. Mm-hmm. So I think, detainees, when they come into a facility with MTC, I think they see the compassion, I guess is what I'll say, from my staff to include the administration, where we're here to help the detainees. We're here to give them as much help as we can here, and change their lives for whether either they stay inside the United States or if they go back to their home country. So I think when they come into an MTC operated facility, I think they're surprised. I really do. Mm-hmm. I make plenty of rounds on a daily, and you know, they just appreciate, you know, what our staff does, what my staff does for them, whether it be with assistance with their case or just on how my staff treats them.
What's the average time someone would be in a detention facility? Anything like that?
Yes, sir. Those are some of the challenges that we as a company face, especially in a detention facility, because the length of stay for a detainee, you know, in a world without COVID, you know, typically before was, 21 days up to 50 days.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of course, with the challenges that COVID, the pandemic has brought, you know, that length of stay went a little bit higher. But, you know, prior to that, you know, the length of stay was very short. So the type of programming that we can afford the population makes it challenging. You know,
how did COVID specifically impact you as far as your operations? What was the most difficult piece about it?
I think just, making sure that we provided my staff, to include the detainee population, the proper PPE that they're supposed to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maintaining the social distancing, you know, not just with my staff, but even inside the housing units for the detainee population. But, you know, I've worked at two other detention centers now, this IEH and to include LY, which is located in Waynesville, Texas. And, you know, I'm real appreciative of my staff and to include even the administrators, because we were proactive and we got the proper PPE that the staff needed to include the detainees. Immediately, last March, when the COVID did hit, we started placing hand sanitizers in high traffic areas so that staff and detainees could sanitize their hands, providing, again, the PPE both to the detainee population and officers. And just trying to explain to them, educate them on the pandemic and the importance of following the guidelines that CDC put out.
Operationally, I'm curious, I mean, you can hold up to 1,000 people. So on any given day, do you have much notice when people are going to bring you folks that are going to be detained and you have to provide services to them? Or is it you never know what's going to happen on any given day as far as the numbers that may be admitted or maybe even be discharged?
As far as the detainees that are going to arrive at the facility, we don't know. Typically, we'll get about a 4-hour notice prior to them getting to the facility. I just don't know. We just don't know how many are going to be coming. You know, some days we'll get 10, some days we'll get 15, some days we'll get 50.
Wow.
It just depends on the management that ICE has and where they need to house the detainees.
So you have to be prepared for almost anything on any given day.
Yes, sir. 24 hours a day. I think what helps a lot with that is the relationship that we have with immigration. You know, we have a good open communication system with them. So we communicate great.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your Employer Management and Training Corporation. Again, you said the bionic philosophy is, believe it or not, I care. For someone who doesn't work for MTC, maybe works for a different correctional agency, you've never heard of that. How would you describe what that looks like in the workplace?
Okay. Well, you know, it's a good topic. I'm glad you bring it up because this year is 40 years, is MTC's 40-year anniversary. Oh. So we see it as 40 years of changing lives. You know, the founder, which is Dr. Robert R. Marquardt, Dr. Bob, you know, he touched thousands of people's lives through his caring and cheerful personality. And we use that, you know, to pretty much, it summed up what the bionic philosophy is, the believe it or not, I care. And I think we show that through, you know, that now it's you know, his son, Scott Marquardt, and his daughter, Jane Marquardt, who are continuing the bionic legacy today. But through them, you know, they demonstrate that caring compassion, both for our staff and the detainee population. You know, that's why we go above and beyond on a program that's required for any contract with any MTC facility that they have. You know, we provide proven programs like, you know, behavior therapies, group mm-hmm. and individual counseling, substance programs, vocational training, academic courses. I mean, just programs to change the way people think and about themselves and, you know, to change their lives. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I would sum up the bionic philosophy.
Yeah, my first exposure to MTC was many years ago, and I won't say where it was, but I was in a cell block, and I was talking to some of the men there, and I never heard of MTC. I just knew it was a private prison, and I asked them. There's probably four guys at the table. I said, would you rather be in an MTC facility or would you rather be another facility? And they said, oh, we'd much rather be at MTC, which kind of surprised me. And I said, what's the difference? And they said, when count clears in the evening and everybody is time for lights out, the officer comes by, and after he does his count and the lights are out, he tells us good night. He said, I've never been told good night by an officer in my life till I came to an MTC prison, which really surprised me. I've always remembered that because it made such an impression upon the incarcerated population in that unit.
No, and that's exactly what the company's about. You know, we have a culture of caring. So, you know, and you know, going through the warden exchange program, some of the topics that we talk about, you know, when we're describing them, I get pictures or I get at least glimpses of, you know, people, you know, certain administrators that I've worked at, that I've learned from to get me to the position that I'm at. And, you know, that's why I'm real big on, you know, it starts with the administration, you know, because I'm the same way. You know, when I'm making my housing units, I ask that detainee, how are you doing today? Have you talked to your kids? Have you talked to your wife? You know, and if they say, no, look, I have this challenge because of this, or whatever the reason may be, then, you know, I see it as that's, you know, that's my job. It's my staff's job. It's that, it's our job to help them get in communication with either their family or with their wife, their aunt, their uncle, or whoever they might have. But, you know, I stress that to my staff, you know, always take that extra step, you know, because our biggest advocate is always going to be the detainee population. You know, every time that, you know, we get, I can't even tell you the number of inspections that we get from outside agencies. You know, and I tell my staff, you know, they're not going to come ask me, you know, what I think of the facility. They're not going to come ask my department heads or my staff because we work here, of course. So, you know, our biggest advocate is always going to be the detainee population. So if you take that extra mile, you take that extra step, you listen to them, you know, you get their feedback because there's always room for improvement everywhere. So whether it be in the kitchen, whether it be in commissary, whether it be in the law library, you know, just getting their feedback of how we could improve the operation, you know, but from staff and detainees, especially the detainees, you know, on the food, you know, when you're preparing a menu for the next year, go get their feedback, see what they want, you know, and let's try to make it work. Try to make them as much home as possible. I get it. It's not home, but I really do feel, and I do believe in my heart that, you know, that's our job is to try to help them as much as we can and make them feel at home as much as possible, as impossible as that is.
Sure. Is there much of a challenge when you're hiring and orientating new staff to orientate them to that philosophy? Because I remember the first prison, before I worked in a prison, I had a typically bad attitude that you pick up from the media, much different than my thoughts are today. So when you're onboarding new staff, is it a challenge at all? Do people come in with a different view just because, and how do you work with that? Is it much of a problem?
If you're getting my honest opinion, I think, you know, it's obvious that, yeah, I think that is a challenge for most facilities across the United States. But the reason that I really like MTC is because they like to be proactive. And, you know, so one thing that we've initiated, not just at this facility, but in every facility throughout the United States that's operated by MTC, is what they call a culture of caring. So that's basically that's more on the staff side. So from day one, when they come in to get their interview, you know, you have somebody there greeting the officer, telling him good morning, walking him in, because let's face it, who wants to walk into a prison? Everybody's nervous. You'd be scared. I was when I first started corrections.
Sure.
You know, so, you know, we try to make them feel as comfortable as possible. And then once they do go through the interview, once they do get hired, we bring them in, you know, and, you know, I'll give you what is an example that every facility does, you know, from the warden all the way down to the last department head. They'll go in there and they'll introduce themselves. And at that point in time is when most wardens go in there and tell them, look, this is what MTC is about. This is what the Bionic philosophy is about. And this is the culture that we're trying to implement here.
And this is a kind of different question too, and I'm not sure how to ask it, so forgive me. You know, I know that some people struggle in corrections leading people who come in with a, I don't know what the right word is, but their view of the incarcerated population is not good because they've, whatever crime they've committed, particularly some crimes are more heinous than others in their view, and it colors their interaction and their view of what they do. with all of the immigration discussion in this country, and it's such a high volatile type area, do you experience that in your line of work since you are in charge of a detention facility, either through staff or through community, that people have difficulty relating to a detention population, or that isn't an issue?
No, it is. It is. I won't say all of them, but some of the employees that we do hire, they do come in with that mentality that I experienced when I first started corrections. You know, they did the crime. Now let's make them do the time.
Yeah.
I think now that all that's, times have changed is what I'm saying. Sure. So now I think some officers do have to adjust, but I think once those employees do come into our facility, and again, once they see the culture that we're trying to implement for staff and the detainee population, I think they adjust. As far as the community goes, we have what we call a community relations council meetings with the community. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do once a quarter. So we invite the community leaders to come in, and at that time is when we actually, display on what we do, not just for the detainee population, but even for the community. As I mentioned, it's MTC's 40th year anniversary this year. So for the first quarter, what we did is we tried to implement a literacy drive. So we got other communities, other agencies to donate books. And then here in the local community where I'm at in Livingston, we reached out to the Boys and Girls Club and we donated those books. So, it creates that community communication. So then the leaders in return come to my community relation councils. And when they come here, we show them what we do, which is all public information on the MTC website, the lives that we're changing, video testimonials from offenders, detainees, from other facilities, to include some from here from IH, and they get to see it firsthand how we change that person's life. So it gives them a different look at what we do.
And I'm assuming that even in a detention facility, you would have volunteers from the community come in and work with the guys that are in your facility?
Yes, sir. What we like to do is, I mentioned some of the programs that most detention facilities try to implement, from education to vocation to life to basic life skills. Mm-hmm. So and even recreation. So, one of the biggest ones is religious services. And due to all the different nationalities that we have, sometimes we have to reach out to volunteers so they could come into the facility and provide those religious services. So we try to get as many volunteers as we can from the community. Of course, they have to go through a clearance and stuff, but.
Sure. Well, two last questions, Alex, before we get to the end of our time. And it's two I always ask, typically correctional people, for sure. You've been in corrections almost 20 years. You came in as a very young man. Now you're a warden. How has corrections changed during your tenure of your career in corrections?
I mentioned it earlier. I think when I first started corrections, the mindset was, okay, they did the crime. Now let's make them do the time. You couldn't go tell a detainee good morning. You couldn't tell him good night. You couldn't shake his hand. Because if anybody saw that, then, you were fired on the spot. It was against policy. And I think all that has changed now. I think now we want to establish that relationship with the detainee. You want to go in there, you want to make your rounds, you want to pick his brain. Hey, how are you doing today? Good morning, good afternoon. How are you doing today? Have you talked to your kids? Just establishing that relationship and knowing your population. It opens up windows for you now, because now they tell you exactly what they got on their mind. And if they feel that something could improve at the facility, that's their opportunity of letting you know. Before, when I started corrections, I don't think that opportunity was there for the detainee population. And I don't think my employees at the time would even think about doing something like that. To where now, we want to have that open communication with the population. It's about helping the offender, now the detainee.
How would you answer someone who has issues with that? Maybe someone who's more old school that would, have a fear of that. What would you say the advantages are over the old way?
Some of the advantages are, one, it shows transparency between the facility, the employees, and the detainee population. And then, most inspections now, like I mentioned earlier, the team, they do various interviews of not my staff. They do my staff too, but a majority of the interviews go with the detainee population now. So when they do those interviews with that population, you know, detainees are honest. They're never going to lie. You know, if they got an issue, they're gonna say, hey, no, this facility doesn't do this. This facility doesn't do that. Or the staff don't do this. They're real rude. But no, I've been blessed to where, you know, most inspections that I've been through, the population says that, no, they appreciate the staff and they appreciate how they're respected. They're treated like human beings and they're helped in whatever way we can.
And the second question is, how have you personally changed? What do you think the biggest change has been in you in the last 20 years as a corrections employee?
You know, when I first started corrections, remember, I was 18. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, I joined corrections, and I did. I fell in love with the SORT, which is, you know, every facility have a special operations response team.
Sure. Each one
has different acronyms for them, but at the time, mine was called the SORT. You know, and I was always, you know, I was ready to go. you know, if we needed to gas, let's gas. If we needed, you know, we needed to activate the team, okay, let's activate the team. Let's do it. You know, a cell extraction, if it needed to be done, I was the first one to volunteer. Mm-hmm. But I think now, you know, being with MTC so long and, you know, being part of that bionic philosophy, I think now I've learned that, you know what, it's good to talk to somebody for 2-3 hours if you could avoid the use of force.
Sure.
You know, because both for the safety of the detainee and to include my staff, because I see some staff get injured on a cell extraction. But, you know, I think the biggest tool in a detention facility, or I think in any correctional facility, not just detention, but, you know, the biggest tool that you could have is being able to communicate with people. Mm-hmm. If you know how to talk to people, I think you could talk at that time, they used to call it verbal judo when I first started corrections. But now it's just communicating with the detainee, you know, asking them, you know, why are you upset? Well, how can I help you? Let me help you. Let me show you. Let me demonstrate the bionic philosophy and show you that, you know, I'm not all about, you know, putting you to bed or putting you behind bars and that's it. No, now it's about, you know, housing the detainees and how can we change his life while he's in your custody? What for he or she, my facility is all males, but you know, what kind of training can I put you through? What kind of academic course can I put you through? So that way, when you do leave the facility, whether it be here in the United States or outside the United States, but even if you go back to your country, what kind of life skill can I give you to change your life even back in your own country? And I think we've done that because, you know, not just this facility, but a couple facilities, because I've promoted through various facilities with MTC. So I basically worked with, pretty much every customer you could think of, from a marshal to BOP to ICE to even the state. And even in all those facilities, you know, I'll give my example for detention, because that's where I'm at right now is detention. We've had detainees that have got deported back to either Nicaragua's or Guatemala, wherever they went. But, you know, once that detainee goes back to his country, he don't have to write a letter to the facility thanking for what we did. But, you know, and that just amazes me. And I praise my staff for that because, you know, and I tell them, look, this detainee didn't have to do that. You know, but when he got to his country, he still took the time to write that letter of appreciation because of the efforts that you guys do. So, you know, I just can't be more appreciative for the staff that I've worked with, for the company, because, you know, from the top to the bottom, they really do believe in the bionic philosophy, the believe it or not, I care. And, you know, it's demonstrated from the founder all the way down to his daughter and his son, who are now still continuing that tradition.
Great. Well, Alex, we're out of time. Thank you a lot for being our guest and opening the window and let us see inside of a detention facility and some of the things that we discussed and about MTC. Appreciate you being a guest on the Reimagining Prison podcast.
Okay. Thank you. And I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Reimagining Prison podcast, produced and sponsored by Prison Fellowship. Tell us what you think by rating and reviewing the Reimagining Prison podcast on iTunes. To reach out with any other feedback or suggestions for future podcast guests, you can email us at reimaginingprisonpodcast@pfm.org. You will find this email address in the description for this episode as well.